Let's sit. No more. Let's learn. Let's evolve. Let's talk. Today is Let's Talk Social Justice with your host, Kevin Yowie.
Yes, that's right. You're listening to AAA Murray Country. It's Tuesday, and you know what that means. We're talking on Let's Talk All Things Social Justice. I'm Kevin Yowie, your host, and it's a pleasure to be with you all this morning. And as a Waka Waka and South Sea Islander man, I am, of course, a visitor to this country here in Meanjin, and like to first begin by acknowledging the traditional owners, caretakers and custodians of these lands in which I meet on here at the AAA studios in West End. I pay my respects to their old people, past and present, and acknowledge their sovereignty has never been ceded. I can't believe we're already in May, and these last few months we've had a jam-packed couple of months focusing here on Let's Talk Social Justice, all things impacting blackfellas across the colony, looking at the youth justice amendments here in Queensland, looking at the climate crises, looking at the housing stuff that we know that a lot of blackfellas are experiencing at the moment. And these next couple of weeks, we're absolutely going to be taking a deep dive into the housing crisis. But we are easing into those conversations. And today, with courtesy of the Brisbane Writers Festival, we've got so many deadly people around Meanjin. Last week, we chatted to Ellen Van Nieuwen about their recently released book, Personal Score, which was reflecting on what it means to centre the lessons of land and to think about that act from the ground up. This week, we are so excited to be joined on the phone by the extraordinary artist, writer, organiser and activist, Lorna Munro, to talk about her poetry, art and power and the ongoing struggle against gentrification and disposition in Redfern and Waterloo. Lorna, welcome to Let's Talk Social Justice.
Well, thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure. I was just saying earlier, when I first met you, I think roughly about 12 months ago, I was emceeing the Queensland Poetry Festival, and you spoke that night. You read some of your poetry work, and I just remember being really flat going into that. It was the Friday night, and I remember thinking, oh, Kevin, you need to stop saying yes to all these events and all these gigs. And I was really, really busted. And then I rocked up, and bloody hell, here's Lorna Munro, here's, you know, Ethan Enoch and a bunch of other poets who delivered absolute fire, Lorna. After hearing you talk, I wanted to go and fight racists in the street. So it's a pleasure having you on my show here on Let's Talk Social Justice.
Well, that's so deadly. Like, it's really lovely to know that, you know, your work hits. It lands.
Oh, yeah. It landed all right. So, Lorna, for people who aren't familiar with yourself or your work, can you please explain who you are, who's your mob, and where are you calling us from today?
So, my name's Lorna Munro. I'm a Wiradjuri Gomeroi poet and podcaster, amongst many things. And I'm calling from Gadigal Nuyera. I'm calling from Waterloo.
Excellent. And, you know, Lorna, I remember actually, I think we got a photo last year and I had posted it, and I actually had a friend message me, and I won't forget it, because she was like, hey, that's that Lorna Munro. Hey, yeah, those Munros don't play, Kevin. They're very staunch. I was like, okay, I know, good to know. Hey, Lorna, as you mentioned, you are a poet, a writer, a multidisciplinary artist, a radio presenter, and longtime organiser and activist in your own community of Redfern and Waterloo. What drives all of this work, and what ties it all together?
Hey, you know, I think the main thing that ties it all together and all these things and all these spaces that I occupy, and I occupy very purposely as well, is being a blackfella.
Hey.
You know, these are the things that I'm interested in. These are the things that I've been guided into and mentored into. These are the experiences and the things that I'm passionate about. And I've just been very lucky to figure out a way where that all aligns.
Yeah, absolutely. Lorna, can you tell us a bit about some of your current projects and what you're working on at the moment?
I'm currently working on a few things. The main thing I think that's becoming very clear that it's going to be something that I'm working on for the rest of my life is the Redfern Waterloo Community Archive that we created in 2019 as a result of the Survival Guide podcast. You know, because we spent 2 years, we spent more than that, but we did 2 seasons producing, researching, presenting, interviewing, collecting our own data, and all that kind of work. And we kind of realised, like, we need to really get serious about documenting the gentrification that's happening in this community, in the whole history of colonization in this country. Because, you know, I think a lot of people don't, I think a lot of people kind of really, it might go over a lot of people's heads, I think, just how long this physical space has been occupied for by the colony. And I think that, you know, we really have an advantage being Sydney Blackfellas, knowing all this history, talking about this history, coming from this community in Redfern, you know, that was the black, the birthplace of black self-determination,
as we know it.
You know, we called this place the Black Capital, and there's many reasons for that. And I, the lessons that this community has been able to share with the rest of our mobs is invaluable to our ongoing survival.
Yeah, so much history down there. I haven't spent a lot of time down south, but I remember 10 years ago, I was actually, when I was doing my social work undergrad at university, I had been interning actually down in Sydney at Qantas, but I got to stay in and around Redfern, but mostly around Newtown there. And I just know in the short time that I spent down there is how proud mob are, or particularly Redfern and Waterloo in that area. Like you say, being the birth of, you know, when blackfellas in this place really started to talk about, you know, self-determination and enact it as well. Lorna, one of the reasons we were super excited to talk to with you for this show is because you have a really distinctive style of poetry and political commentary, which often blurs the line between politics and art in a really interesting way. And, you know, I seen that firsthand last year when I listened to you speak and read some of your poetry. I'm wondering, what got you into poetry in the first instance?
I've always been a weird girl. I've always been a little bit of a geek.
We like weird people. We like that, yes.
You know, it is the weird girl era.
Yeah, we're really leaning into that, yeah.
Yeah, it's cool to be different. It's cool to have your own special interests. More and more people are learning about your diversity, and, you know, my son is autistic, nonverbal as well, so that, I think that, like, that's something that I'm going to spend the rest of my life really thinking about, you know. The position that I found myself in, being someone that talks so well and gets asked to talk, and, you know, that's my main tool, that's my preferred tool, that's my preferred weapon. And then, like, having a baby and having a son who's nonverbal, and what does that mean, you know, what's that's like. But I think, like, for me, when I was younger, I was always writing, I was always reading. Growing up in Redfern, I was exposed to black theatre as a child. You know, the first plays that I seen were blackfellas, an all-black cast doing, like, a Shakespeare adaptation of The Midsummer Night's Dream, you know, and that's my favourite, like, Shakespeare play.
Oh, is it really?
I
did.
Later on when I studied theatre, I was just going to say, like, I played the Queen of the Fairies and Titania, and, you know, I had, like, I had my black fairies kind of crew that followed me everywhere.
I love
and
that.
It was just really nice to revisit that. But, yeah, no, I think as well, I've had opportunities to travel as a young person and seeing the other young people really occupy space and, you know, share their stories via spoken word in places like in New York and Texas. And, you know, there's a lot of these communities that are were really vibrant when I was a young person out in the world that I didn't see here in this country. So for me, you know, I've got all these influences and all these things that have really pushed me to be in the position that I'm in now. But also the fact that when I was a young person, I went out there and I seen all these people, or young people, you know, not scared of getting up and talking and telling their stories and giving their testimonies and stuff like that. And when I came back to this country, I just remember the only place that I was able to do that was at the Tambasi. The only place that I was really encouraged to do that in this society was via Black politics.
And Luna, thank you for, you know, mentioning your son. You know, I've got a brother who he's 19, who's got who will live an entire life with disabilities. And I guess until you have a family member who is impacted by some of these conditions, you're not really forced to think about it. And I thank you for sharing that with us on today's show, because I'm sure there's many listeners who are either themselves or supporting family with different, you know, medical conditions and with different abilities. So, and you know, it's funny that you talk about Midsummer Night Dream, because I did drama back in high school, and I remember for our grade 12 presentation we had to do Midsummer Night's Dream, and it was fun. It was very different to any of the sort of plays I had done up until that point, because I'd done a few different musicals in high school, but when I come across that, it was a fun role to play. It was different. It was nice to get amongst it. Lorna, in the next few shows, we're kicking off a deep dive into housing justice movements in so-called Australia. We were really excited that this lined up with our chat with you because of your previous podcasting projects, which you alluded to earlier, called Survival Guide, which traced the ongoing disposition of Black communities in Redfern and Waterloo through processes of gentrification, a topic very relevant to listeners in and around West End here in so-called Queensland. For listeners who don't know much about the area, can you tell us a bit more about the history of Redfern and Waterloo and why it's so important to Blackfellas? I guess you touched on it a bit earlier.
The main thing about this community is, and, you know, just to give a bit of background, is, you know, this was the first place that we had the first Aboriginal medical services that you could walk in before that people had to go to emergency rooms in the hospitals, you know, and then this was the first of its kind ever in this country, let alone, you know, the first for Blackfellas. So those ideas were taken from the Black Panthers. Those ideas were taken from a lot of First Nations reclamation movements and land rights movements that were happening in places like Canada and New Zealand and the Pacifica. So, you know, my parents' generation and all that generation that, you know, gets quoted and name-dropped a lot, I guess, today. You know, these are all the great Black thinkers, writers, talkers, organisers, mobilisers. You know, these people wrote the formats pretty much for a lot of governance systems that exist in our communities today. But the background to that was that our mobs were escaping the missions, and they were running away to the city to escape the, the Aboriginal Protection Act, pretty much.
Yeah.
So you end up with a situation in the 1960s, the inner city area having the highest Black population in the country.
Mm.
So they say somewhere around like 40,000 Blackfellas was here. This, you know, Redfern and Waterloo are very small suburbs as well.
Yeah.
It's a very concentrated sort of area to have that many Blackfellas in one place. So really that was the driving force behind what made Redfern such an historic, iconic Black community, was the fact that you had Aboriginal people, Black faces everywhere. You've seen Black faces in the shop fronts, in the organisations, you've seen them at dances, you've seen them on stage, you've seen them, you know, everywhere. And today, in 2023, we've arrived at a situation where, at the last census, there's only like 300 Blackfellas left here in this place. So, you know, when we talk about the history of colonisation and literally having a view of the forefront of where, you know, those white ghosts first stepped off that ship in 1770, and then, you know, again in 1788. Well, they tried to get off the ship in 1770, but, you know, you can go back and look at that history for people who want to know the details around that. You know, Brian McKelly's done some brilliant work with reinvoking that part of our history as well, and really mid-slaying a lot.
Yeah.
But, you know, the community here had a large population, and it was not lost on our people that we were literally building a big black community on the forefront of invasion.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you touched on it a little bit earlier, and I guess this ties into, you know, that yarn exactly, is what exactly was Survival Guide as a podcast? What was it about? And how does that tie into what you were just yarning about?
Survival Guide was somewhat of a survival toolkit for other mobs to understand the lessons of Redbird in order to have some strategy, in order to navigate that wave of colonization that would then hit their country, you know, at different times. I think it's a very interesting thing, the way that we think about colonization. And I think what Survival Guide did was very clearly break down what those waves of colonization looks like and in what order they come and how our people have survived it.
Lorna, one of the key themes across a lot of your work is around gentrification as a process of colonization and the importance of resisting the displacement of blackfellas from suburbs like Redfern and Waterloo. I'm wondering, can you explain for listeners who haven't heard the term before, what exactly is gentrification?
I say that gentrification is colonization. It's just sold to us in a different way.
Yep.
It's sold to us in a way where it's marketed that it's good for us. Colonization removes Indigenous peoples so that colonizers can commodify land and resources.
Yeah.
Gentrification is exactly the same thing. Instead of just Aboriginal people, it's all poor people that are removed from public housing, and then that's redeveloped for a better community, you know, a better looking community, a more vibrant community, all these words that we see in public development.
They like to call them little villages too. I see that pop, that word like to be thrown around a lot as well. Lorna, I know for listeners who are familiar with the Brisbane Meanjin area, as a young fellow, I grew up on Butchala Country up in Hervey Bay, but I always heard lots of stories from my mum's one of eight, and from my mum, my aunties and uncles, from a lot of, you know, mob from Hervey Bay who come down to Brisbane. And once upon a time, New Farm, which isn't too far from where I am at the moment in West End, just across the river, New Farm was a very vibrant black community. And, you know, you talk to people from my mum's generation, they'll talk about all the different families and family groups that used to live in and around New Farm. And you look at what's happened there in the last 25 years, in terms of exactly what you say, the gentrification, blackfellas just don't live there anymore, Lorna, in the very similar way as you talk about, you know, Redfern and Waterloo. It's something that is happening across this continent in all types of ways. And, you know, what you talk about in terms of your Survival Guide podcast, which you did, researching the data and looking at everything, I think it's really important for people to understand the way in which colonization continues in this place. I'm wondering, Lorna, what does gentrification look like in practice in communities like so-called Sydney?
Well, I think, you know, the physical embodiment of that is the fact that you walk down Redfern Street today, a place that is a historically black community, and you won't see black faces the way that you've seen them before. You're lucky to run into maybe a handful of black fellows. Whereas when I was younger growing up, it was every person you've seen on Redfern Street was black.
Well, even growing up in so-called Queensland, I always remember people would talk about Redfern and the block. And I know that as an adult, when I first started to visit down that way, that was very prominent in my mind. And like you say, I guess I didn't have the same experience as, say, my mum's generation of visiting Sydney in terms of, seeing the black faces around, right?
Well, my cousins from, you know, Ramby Mission or from Maureen, that when they come down to Sydney, they used to say, this is like a big mission in the middle of the city.
Hey, yeah, yeah.
And I thought that was like a real good way to explain it as well. And, you know, coming, like, it's interesting coming from such a famous black community as well, because, you know, we grew up in public housing. We grew up very poor. We grew up with my parents volunteering at all these organisations. You know, they never got paid. There's a whole black industry now that a lot of people have careers, you know, on. And the people who set it up, they literally were on a volunteer basis.
Yeah.
You know, but on the flip side of that, I got to meet Janet Jackson when I was a kid.
Hey! Miss Jackson, if you're nasty, hey?
Yeah, no, because you know what? She come out here, she said, I want to see black people.
There now.
And this is the beauty about Redfern is, you know, internationally as well as locally, Redfern has been a place for people to meet each other, to find other mob, to find black people, to, you know, create some kind of family structure, if you will, or kinship even, some kind of relationality to that place. And I really understand that as a black fella, because, you know, and I feel like there's this global sort of thing that, you know, a lot of Indigenous people all over the world, when they come here, they are thirsty for that relationality. They need that relationality, because when they come here, they have sold the type of Australia that is, you know, blonde women laying across the beaches of our countries.
Yeah.
And, or, you know, washing their hair with botanical shampoo and conditioner in a waterfall.
Yes, you know? Or playing cricket in the backyard or something. That you're absolutely right. There is an image that Australia likes to sell of itself. And it's funny that you mentioned Janet Jackson, but I think Snoop was there at some point. I mean, you have everyone down there, to be fair. Like, yeah. There's not many famous black artists who have come to Australia and have not crossed through Redfern.
No, and I love the fact that this is my community. And through the work with the archives, a lot of the work that goes along with that is going into aunties and uncles' houses and, you know, building that relationship and showing them that I'm not going to go and steal their photos, their most prime bragging rights photo of them with Muhammad Ali back in the 70s.
Yay.
Or being kissed by Whoopi Goldberg as a baby down at Marawina.
Hey.
You know, like, my job is really trying to get these yarns out, get people talking and remembering what this community was like. And there's a lot of healing that comes from that as well. But, you know, we all love to see the aunties and uncles bring out photos of the famous people.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, like, when my first time visiting down that way, I remember you're walking past the block and the very famous, you know, the Aboriginal flag that was painted on the back of one of those buildings there. And I remember having a photo, and the first thing I did was send it to Mum, because that's just what we did when we visited, you know, Sydney and Redfern, is, you know, those photos. And then to be able to hear stories from families who have visited. So I love that the work that you're engaged in, Lorna, is about not just revitalizing that, but just capturing it, I guess, in a way that is accessible for people. Lorna, you've been doing some activism in your own communities of Redfern, as we know, and Waterloo lately, around some changes to social housing accessibility in the area under a new local allocation strategy that would see people applying for social housing in these areas subjected to criminal record checks. Lorna, for our listeners who may not know, can you talk a little bit about what's going on with this, what do they call it, a local allocation strategy, and what it means in practice?
Yeah, definitely. So if you want a bit more of a context around the history of policy making in regards to the current levels of gentrification, the current levels of displacement that's happening here, that, you know, will kind of be rippled across the rest of the country, very much like colonisation. You can go and listen to the Survival Guide. We actually break down a lot of policies and actually really examined the way in which it was worded, the way that they were mail-dropped into everybody's letterboxes, the panic that people had waking up, you know, and finding out that their homes were going to be demolished in whatever amount of time. So, you know, to get a good understanding of that, like, you should go listen, you need to go listen to Survival Guide.
And how would our listeners engage with Survival Guide, Lorna?
So Survival Guide is on Spotify. I think season one's on Spotify. But the whole complete series can be found on Radio Skid Row's Indigenous First Nations content page. And you've got, like, a few years of content there, as well as Survival Guide. You've got the 232, 232 minutes for 232 years, Day of Mourning broadcast that I did. That was epic, you know, listening and researching and producing efforts. You've also got like a lot of content of me training up a lot of other people that are now moved on to much bigger and better things as well. So it's interesting to hear that. But this new strategy, well, that I just found out about and I've been sharing and talking about because I know not many people here talking about it or know about it, is that LAS policy. And I found out about it because of a multitude of things. We've been waiting for a transfer. We're literally living in a house with black mold. Like, it's made me sick. It's made kids sick. There's a lot of structural problems with the house. And I've been, you know, pushing to get moved for a while. And then my service provider said, you know, you're just one permission slip away from, you know, being on priority list or whatever for a transfer. You need to sign this paperwork. And I asked what it was, and they explained to me what it was. And I was just like, all right, well, you know, I don't really have a choice. I have to, it's either here living in this house and getting sick or signing this thing that I don't really agree with, that I actually feel is very violent in ways and can be used very violently against mobs. So basically what it looks like is no one in the inner city can apply for public transport, apply for public housing after 2018 unless they have a clear police record.
That's outrageous, so Lorna.
And they've been moving towards this for a while. I remember a few years ago they made a new policy that, like, if people were locked up, they lost their house.
Wow.
And, you know, as a black fella, we're aware of the statistics. We're aware of, you know, the large portions of our community and incarceration rates and kids being locked up in this country. You know, the overwhelmingly, the growth in the women's statistics in incarceration as well. Like, it's something that I'm pretty sure we're all well versed in. So for me, when I heard that, I could literally picture the people that were part of this community that could no longer be a part of this community, and then found out about this stuff with the drug charges. So this stuff with the LAS policy is you cannot be housed in a public housing property in inner city area that is Glebe, Redfern, Waterloo, Paddington, Piedmont, those in surrounding areas, if you've got a history of drug charges or if you've got a drug charge.
It's outrageous. Now, you know,
this is in a community that's heavily policed as well.
Yeah.
Can I just say, I've had people say to me that they've never actually seen so many police patrolling streets the way that they do here and the way that they have been doing here pretty much all my life. As a young person getting the chance to travel, I actually see more police at my front door and in my flat monitoring who goes in and out of the flat than I ever did at any international airport. So I think that, like that, you know, but we have to really understand in this community, people have been criminalized without being locked up.
Yeah.
We've had kids literally being taken to their deaths who were classified as deaths in custody. Like, we don't have deaths in custody in jails here. We've had them on the streets.
Yeah. And, you know, for a lot of our listeners, this will be, you know, for some, the first time hearing of what's actually going on in Redfern. So you spent your whole life there. Like, in terms of the 300 people that are still blackfellow that are still, you know, in the area, what's the sense amongst the community in terms of seeing Redfern what it is now and knowing that it isn't the place that it was, say, you know, in the 60s, 70s, 80s and 90s? Is there a sense of you know, camaraderie, kinship, mateship, in terms of what's going on down there for mob?
I think, you know, there is, to some extent, there is that community. There's some remnants of that community that I grew up in.
Yeah.
But the community that I'm raising my children in today is very different from the community that I was raised in, and then the community that my parents first came to as young people.
What does housing justice mean to you, both in the context of your work in Redfern and Waterloo, and as a black fella?
Housing justice is the right to have a family, is to be safe, and to live a life. You know, you need a stable, healthy, happy environment to have all these other things. And, you know, if we don't get the basics right, then we're forever playing catch-up. And I think, you know, it's the great Australian dream, right, to own a house. So why is it that poor people and, you know, a lot of black fellas in that as well, why can't we aspire to those dreams as well? Why can't we have houses and land and a safe and happy environment to raise our children in? Like, we talk about breaking cycles. How are we going to do that when we don't have a healthy, happy environment to be in?
Absolutely. Drawing on my social work training I remember learning about Maslow's hierarchy of needs when I was a university student, and Maslow's hierarchy of needs talks about this pyramid, and on the bottom rung it's got things like water and shelter, and then it might move up to clothing, and then it might move up to, you know, relationships. And anyway, Maslow talks about this pyramid in terms of, well, the top is where we need to be, but we can't get to the top unless the bottom, and like you say, have a really strong foundation. It's very hard to succeed in this society, to live, to grow, to nurture, to love, to birth children, to raise families, to stay connected. Mm-hmm. Very hard to do these things if you do not have a home to go to.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
And you know, too, I was just going to say, I've got to acknowledge my great auntie. Everyone else knows them as Mum Shirl.
Hey, yes.
You know, she said, like, you know, I've got kids coming to me from Redfern School, and they're getting in trouble, and, you know, they're being called naughty little black so-and-so or whatever, and that's a direct, you know, quote. And then when she asks the kids what's really going on, they're saying, but I'm hungry, Auntie. How am I going to sit there and concentrate when my belly's literally screaming at me?
There now.
You know, I didn't have to read all of these other people saying the same things that our elders have been saying in my community for much longer, not to discredit like your learning and stuff like that, but I just love how someone can quote stuff to me and all these like thoughts and methodologies and stuff like that, and I've always got an elder that I can say, well, this person said that to me, you know, and it was directly said to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, your great aunt and Mum Shirl, who we all know her as, and, you know, even the activists that have come out of that place, Lorna, you know. And, you know, when I had a photo with you, and, you know, my friend messages me and go, hey, you know, the Munros, they don't play. You know, Lorna comes from a big family down there. And I guess, you know, what's it like to grow up in such a politically active, well-known as well, like very well-known. We spoke about, you know, everyone around the place knew about Redfern and that area. What was it like to have, you know, to have that privilege of growing up with such staunch activists around you?
To be honest, I didn't really quite understand the significance of it until I got a lot older. Mm. When I was studying at uni and, you know, meeting other black fellas that were studying, and they were literally quoting my parents back to me.
Yeah,
and I thought, like, that's strange. Like, I'm like, I still can't get used to that. I'll probably never get used to that. And it's just a very interesting, you know, as an adult and as a young person creating educational programs, it was only through these things that I realized I had a very significant upbringing and a very significant black learning.
Yeah, absolutely. You
know, that was facilitated by my mother and father. You know, I also come from two big black families, not just one as well, you know. For me as a young person, growing up, a lot of my friends and family, my age and my generation, would come to me for help. And I seen that happened a lot in my house. Like, there was always people coming through to ask for advice or, you know, seek guidance and counsel from people like my parents and my aunties and uncles and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And my mum always said, you know, we don't measure wealth the same way colonizers do. We measure wealth in how loved you are and how respected you are in community, and how respected and loved you are by the people that seek your counsel regularly.
Absolutely.
I think that's just a really, yeah, it's just a really beautiful sentiment that hasn't, you know, I've really taken on, I guess. Lorna, so, you know, when we talk about esteemed elders and stuff like that, they're esteemed elders because of how many people rely on them for help and seek their guidance and seek their counsel.
Absolutely. And Lorna, you know, across a lot of your work, you really centre the way that blackfellas across the continent are resisting and refusing colonisation in diverse ways. And, you know, I love that, you know, that you gave your, as you always do, you know, your family, your community, a massive shout out for the political work they have done over, you know, the course of decades and in resisting colonisation since their first arrival. Do you think artists have a role to play in honouring and amplifying practices of resistance?
Oh, definitely. I think that's a bit of an obligation too, you know. When you've got the microphone, you need to be using it accordingly and, that means many different things. I think for me, the community and the family that I come from was a great basis for me to figure out some things for myself, which was how do I use this skill, this gift that I've been given from Creator, how can I use that to help me and my family and my mob? You know, and like I said, like when I was a young person traveling overseas and seeing all these open word movements and stuff like that happen, all these young people were talking about their truth. They were talking about stuff that other people didn't necessarily want to hear. But the way that they presented it was so convincing that it was hard to ignore. Yeah. And also, you know, I'm a school of that history. I grew up part of that generation that was literally the last generation to see black theatre in Redfern as it was. And this is the start of the whole black industry, you know, with the starting of black theatre and the dance theatre and NASA and, you know, all these great institutions, cultural institutions we have today.
Yep.
You know, Gary Foley, I think he said that they had spent a lot of resources, a lot of energy talking to crowds of people during the marches. And he said, you know, during his stint as Black Theatre, he probably reached a lot more people, making them laugh in the theatres, than what he could ever do out in the streets.
Yeah,
and
wow.
My Uncle Paul also said Black Theatre was just as much about land rights as it was about self-representation. And I think a lot of artists today have forgotten that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And Lorna, you spoke about, you know, for listeners, they can Google Survival Guide. They can have a look on Spotify. We think season one's up there. For your own poetry and work, Lorna, where can some of our listeners engage in that?
There's a few things here and there. I'm actually trying to work on a book at the moment. I've again found myself in a really interesting situation because I've refused to publish a lot of work because I don't quite like how my words and especially my language work sits on white paper. I've been working very hard to subvert a lot of these things, but it's come to the point where, you know, now I'm having to rethink accessibility. So back in the day, I used to refuse to publish anything. My whole take was you got to come to a show and you got to hear my voice and you got to feel it. Mm. And, you know, now I am really, really interrogating the ways in which I'm making my work accessible for, you know, hard hearing mob, for mob that can't read text, you know, just trying to make sure that my work is accessible for all the different capabilities. And, you know, you want everyone to feel something. Poets are always trying to make people feel something. And I guess that's why poets are such a danger to society as well. And, you know, because they can invoke a feeling and they can cut through rhetoric and dialogue and, you know, make someone feel something. And if you're going to change the world, that's the way you can do it.
Absolutely.
You can't change the way people think unless you change the way people feel. And, so I'm trying to examine that. There's a bit of work online. You can find some of my old stuff. I've got a bit of work in publications, I think. The Way You, Four Old Times, which was a Red Room anthology. Yeah, always kind of trying to figure out how to get my work out there. Yeah,
absolutely. Yep. And, you know, for listeners, you know, who haven't had the pleasure of listening to Lorna Munro, if you ever are crossing a community event here or elsewhere, absolutely stop and absolutely buy a ticket, attend any show where Lorna is speaking, because Lorna speaks about, you know, poets being a danger to society, in terms, a threat rather, because of the feelings that they invoke. And I can tell you, having the pleasure of listening to Lorna Munro speak absolute fire, invoked many things. And I remember even just being there with friends, and we all just sort of went, yeah, wow. Like, I mean, we knew, you know, everyone was going to be deadly, but we just didn't know everyone was going to be that deadly, Lorna Munro. And you are absolutely that deadly. So I want to thank you for joining me on Let's Talk Social Justice. And thank you for the yarn, not just about your poetry and your work, but how that relates to and ties together with your activism in the community in which you live, and I know that you're very proud of. So thank you, Lorna Munro, for joining me, and I hope to cross paths with you sometime in the future.
Yeah, we'll definitely see each other. Thank you so much, and I hope that everyone's got a little bit of fire in their belly for the rest of the day and the rest of the week. And again, thank you, and I'll see you soon.
No worries. Folks, if you want to listen to that again, remember you can find us on Spotify, Let's Talk, or you can jump online, the AAA website. You can hear that interview again. Or if you want to catch up with any of the shows from the previous weeks and months, jump online and do that. If you want to follow me on socials, you can follow me on Twitter at Kevin Yaoyi, or on Instagram, Kevin.Yaoyi. Don't send me friend requests on Facebook. I've got too many friend requests sitting there that I haven't responded to. So thank you, everyone, and we'll see you all next week. Bye.
No more whispering in our mind. Let's Talk, Monday to Friday at 9 a.m. on AAA Murray Country, the National Indigenous Radio Service and iHeartRadio. You can catch up on AAA.org.au, proudly supported by the Community Broadcast Foundation.